In the quiet Derbyshire village of Eyam, a tailor's bundle of cloth from London arrived carrying more than fine fabric. It brought invisible death. Geraldine Brooks' Year of Wonders recounts this remarkable true story from 1665 to 1666, when the bubonic plague devastated a small mining community whose inhabitants made the extraordinary decision to quarantine themselves rather than risk spreading the disease. The novel has captivated readers worldwide since its publication in 2001, earning praise from literary critics and becoming a book club favorite for its powerful exploration of human resilience in the face of catastrophe. Brooks, a former war correspondent, discovered Eyam's story while hiking in England, a chance encounter that led to this meticulously researched historical novel. The book's haunting premise resonates particularly strongly in our post-pandemic world, with readers finding eerie parallels between the 17th-century plague village and modern experiences of isolation and loss. Through the eyes of young widow Anna Frith, Brooks crafts a tale that Stephen King called a wonder indeed, a remarkable achievement, while The New Yorker praised its elegant, affecting prose that brings this forgotten historical sacrifice vividly to life. The autumn of 1665 should have been like any other in the small Derbyshire village of Eyam. For Anna Frith, a young widow struggling to raise two small boys after her husband's death in the lead mines, life had finally begun to improve. The arrival of a lodger, George Vickers, a journeyman tailor, brought both income and unexpected warmth to her cottage. George formed a bond with Anna's son Jamie, getting down on all fours to give him rides and crafting costumes from fabric scraps. Unlike the stern Puritan babysitter Jane Martin, George played freely with the child, bringing laughter back into their home. George's presence also brought the wider world to Anna's doorstep. Though born nearby, he had worked in Plymouth, London, and Canterbury, regaling Anna with tales of turbaned Barbary seamen, veiled Muslim wives, and London's crowded streets where people lived heaped up 10 and 12 to a room. One evening, after sharing scandalous verses from the Earl of Rochester, George surprised Anna with a golden green dress that matched her eyes. When she hesitated to accept such a gift, he kissed her, awakening desires she had forgotten. Their moment was interrupted by George's sudden fever, and Anna sent him to bed with a cooling draught, her mind in turmoil about these reawakened feelings. The next morning, Anna found George transformed, his face blotched with rose-like rings, a massive yellow-purple lump on his neck, and his body racked with fever. When she tried to help him, the boil burst, releasing pus and a terrible stench. Despite his pleas for her to leave lest she catch his foul contagion, Anna stayed to care for him. George's dying words, "Burn it all," would haunt her later when she realized the plague had arrived in a bundle of cloth from London. In the weeks that followed, the disease spread with terrifying speed. First, young Edward Cooper succumbed to fever, followed quickly by his brother Jonathan and stepfather Alexander. Then, tragedy struck Anna's home. Baby Tom developed a fever despite Anna's desperate care. Her cold stepmother, Afra, chastised her for loving an infant so deeply, while Eleanor Montpellion, the rector's wife, provided genuine comfort. Anna spent Tom's final hours holding him, waking to find his body leaked with blood. Jamie fell ill next, developing a painful swelling in his armpit that resisted all treatment. The plague had begun its devastating march through the village, claiming victims seemingly at random, leaving survivors to wonder why they had been spared. In times of crisis, communities often seek scapegoats, and Eyam proved no exception. As the plague claimed more victims, frightened villagers turned their fear toward the Gowdy women, Mem and her niece Anis, who lived on the village outskirts. These women possessed knowledge of herbal remedies passed down through generations, treating ailments from fevers to difficult births. They lived independently, gathering plants from the hills and helping those in need without judgment. Anis Gowdy particularly drew suspicion for her unconventional lifestyle. Unlike other village women, she lived freely, choosing lovers as she pleased and speaking her mind. Her beauty and confidence made her both admired and feared. When traditional remedies failed against the plague, whispers began that the Gaudi's herbs were ineffective because they served darker powers. The desperate need to blame someone for the inexplicable horror overtaking the village found its target in these women who lived outside society's strict boundaries. The tragedy unfolded swiftly. A mob gathered, dragging Anis from her cottage to the village green. There, they accused her of witchcraft, claiming she had brought the plague through demonic pacts. When Anna begged her to recant, Anis gave a ghostly smile that seemed to blame Anna for betrayal. Bathed in sudden sunlight, Anis's amber eyes gleamed yellow as she launched into a shocking confession, claiming she had lain with Satan alongside several villagers' wives. She described these encounters in lurid detail, laughing wildly until the rope snapped tight around her neck. Michael Mompelion, the village rector, arrived too late to save Anis. Finding her already dead, her beautiful face purple and bloated, he cut her down with his knife. When Martin Highfield attempted to defend their actions by citing Anis's confession, Mompelion roared that the devil was indeed present, not in Anis, but in their own ugly thoughts and evil doubting. He commanded them to pray for God's mercy, and the villagers fell to their knees, weeping. Mem Gaudi, nearly drowned by the mob, died days later at the rectory under Anna and Eleanor's care, her once strong hands now frail as finches' bones. With the Gaudi's deaths, much of the village's medical knowledge vanished. The authorities refused to prosecute the killers, fearing plague contamination. On Sunday, the surviving mob members donned penitence robes in church, but their remorse came too late to save the women whose only crime had been knowledge and independence in a world that feared both. As plague deaths mounted through the summer of 1665, Michael Mompelion gathered the remaining villagers in the half-empty church for a sermon that would change their lives forever. Standing in his pulpit, his face gaunt from sleepless nights spent ministering to the dying, he proposed something unprecedented: a voluntary quarantine of the entire village to prevent spreading the disease to neighboring communities. "We are, in effect, a parish of the dead," he declared, his voice filling the hushed church. "But we have been given a chance to save others from our fate." Mompelion argued that God had chosen them for this sacrifice, comparing their suffering to ore being refined in a furnace, a metaphor that resonated with the mining community. He revealed he had already conferred with Thomas Stanley, a Puritan minister who had left the parish years before, and together they had arranged for provisions to be left at the boundary stone with payment placed in vinegar-filled holes to kill contagion. The rector's words fell on a congregation already transformed by grief. Nearly every family had lost someone to the plague. The pews where neighbors once sat now stood empty, silent testimonies to the disease's toll. As Mompelion spoke, Anna observed the faces around her, some nodding in grim determination, others wide-eyed with fear. For many, the decision meant certain death. Yet the alternative, carrying the disease to unsuspecting villages beyond, seemed unthinkable. After reflection and persuasion from both ministers, all villagers present pledged to remain, except the Bradfords, the wealthiest family in the parish, who slipped away to prepare their escape to Oxfordshire. Their departure created a bitter division that would never heal, marking them as cowards who abandoned their neighbors in the hour of greatest need. The decision sealed, the village erected boundary stones marking where outsiders should leave provisions and where payment could be collected. Families settled into a new reality of isolation, knowing that help would remain at arm's length while death moved freely among them. This extraordinary act of communal sacrifice would ultimately save countless lives beyond Iam's borders, though at a terrible cost to those within. The plague year stripped away social conventions, revealing people's true natures in ways both inspiring and disturbing. As death became a daily companion, villagers responded according to the core of their character, some rising to unexpected heights of courage, while others descended into cruelty or madness. Anna Friff, once a simple housemaid and mother, discovered reservoirs of strength she never knew existed. After losing her children, she channeled her grief into helping others, learning herbal medicine from Eleanor Montpelion and applying the knowledge left by the murdered Gowdy women. When Mary Daniels went into difficult labor with a breech birth, Anna successfully delivered the baby by remembering Mem Gowdy's techniques. "I explore the unborn baby's position," she recalled, "working gently to identify a foot rather than a hand, knowing the difference would be crucial." This success marked a turning point in Anna's transformation from grieving mother to village healer. Others found different paths through the crisis. Jane Martin, once a strict young girl who tended Anna's children, sought oblivion in drink and became known for wanton behavior. Andrew Merrick retreated to a solitary hut on Sir William Hill, unable to bear human company in his fear. Most disturbing was John Gordon, who turned to extreme religious penance, flagellating himself with a scourge embedded with nails. Anna encountered him on the path to the well, emaciated and half-naked, fresh blood trickling into dried tracks on his skin. When she begged him to stop, he only murmured Latin prayers and continued his self-punishment. The plague also revealed the darkest aspects of human nature. Anna's father, a bitter man who had abused her throughout childhood, turned grave-digging into a shameful business, demanding exorbitant payment from grieving families, pewter plates, barrels of herring, pregnant sows, or brass heirlooms. When Christopher Unwin, the sole survivor of a family of 12, began recovering from plague, Anna's father attempted to murder him in his sleep, then buried him alive to steal his possessions. Only Christopher's miner's instinct to face the dirt and dig saved him. Even the seemingly virtuous revealed hidden flaws. Michael Montpelion, whose eloquence and courage had inspired the village to quarantine themselves, harbored a dark secret about his marriage to Eleanor. He had denied her physical love for years as penance for a youthful indiscretion, twisting his own desires into what he called holy fire. This revelation would eventually shatter Anna's faith in him and in the religious certainties that had structured village life. As the plague ravaged Eam, it also eroded traditional beliefs, forcing survivors to question whether divine punishment or natural phenomena caused their suffering. This intellectual struggle played out most visibly in Anna's evolving worldview as she moved between religious faith and scientific inquiry. Initially, like most villagers, Anna accepted Michael Montpelion's interpretation of the plague as God's test, a furnace to refine their souls through suffering. The rector's sermons provided a framework for understanding the inexplicable tragedy, offering hope that their sacrifice held spiritual meaning. Yet, as Anna worked alongside Eleanor Montpelion, learning to treat the sick with herbal remedies, she began questioning whether human action might affect the plague's course. "I wondered why we insisted on seeing the plague as either God's test or the devil's work," Anna reflected, "rather than simply a thing in nature, like a stone that trips us." This revolutionary thought, that disease might have natural rather than supernatural causes, placed Anna at the forefront of a shift in thinking that would eventually lead to modern medicine. Perhaps if we spent less time pondering celestial designs and more on understanding how the disease spread, she reasoned, we might save ourselves. Anna's intellectual journey paralleled her growing medical skills. Working with Eleanor, she mapped the plague spread through the village, noting patterns, how it targeted the young and those in their prime, while sparing the elderly who were veterans in fighting sickness. This analytical approach, combined with practical herbal knowledge, represented an emerging scientific mindset challenging traditional explanations. Meanwhile, superstition flourished among those desperate for protection. Afra, Anna's stepmother, exploited this fear by disguising herself as Aeneas Gowdy's ghost, selling fraudulent charms against the plague. Others resorted to folk remedies like passing naked infants through brambles. The rector discovered the Mowbrays performing this ritual with their scratched, crying baby, revealing how quickly people abandoned church teachings when they failed to provide safety. The intellectual battle between faith and reason culminated after Eleanor's death, when Michael Montpelion lost his faith entirely. I believed that we were God's instruments, he confessed to Anna. Now I see that we were deceived. For Anna, however, the journey led not to atheism, but to a more nuanced understanding, a tentative hope, perhaps, rather than blind faith, combined with practical knowledge that would eventually guide her to a new life as a healer. Throughout the plague year, Michael Montpellier carried the village's spiritual and often physical burdens on his shoulders. As rector, he provided not only religious guidance, but practical leadership, digging graves when others wouldn't, comforting the dying, and making the crucial decision to quarantine the village. His commanding presence and eloquence inspired villagers to make unimaginable sacrifices. Yet beneath his public strength lay a complex, troubled soul. When the plague first struck, Montpellier transformed from scholarly preacher to tireless worker. Anna found him digging graves in the churchyard, exhausted but determined. With the sexton John Millstone dead and able-bodied men scarce, he took on this grim labor himself. Despite Anna's concerns, he continued until nightfall, then conducted burials by candlelight as families brought their dead without coffins, dragging them on blankets. Even after this exhausting work, he rode out to attend more dying villagers when called. His extraordinary willpower drove him beyond normal human endurance. At Jacob Merrill's deathbed, he provided tender comfort, assuring the dying man that God understood human weakness. When Christopher Unwin was buried alive by Anna's father, Montpellier's righteous fury led him to support the traditional mining punishment of hand impalement. Yet, he showed mercy to Jane Martin and others who succumbed to fear or despair during the crisis. This public persona of strength and compassion masked private torment. Eleanor had once explained to Anna that Michael wasn't from distinguished lineage. His father was a mere curate who joined parliamentary forces during the Civil War, only to be mortally wounded by his own men when attempting to return home. Left destitute, young Michael worked on Eleanor's family estate, where his intelligence earned him education at Cambridge. He returned to find Eleanor recovering from some personal ordeal, offering friendship that blossomed into love. The full truth emerged only after Eleanor's death, when Montpellier revealed to Anna that he had denied his wife physical intimacy throughout their marriage as penance for her having terminated a pregnancy before they met. This cruel punishment, disguised as religious principle, exposed the darker side of his character, a rigid moralism that judged his beloved wife more harshly than strangers. My Eleanor, I had to be assured, was cleansed, or else risk the loss of her for eternity, he explained coldly to Anna. When she questioned his compassion toward others like Jacob Merrill and Jane Martin, he admitted he had been lenient with them only because they mattered less to him than Eleanor. This revelation shattered Anna's image of him as a man of true compassion and revealed how personal trauma and religious fervor had twisted his understanding of love. In a society where women held little formal power, the plague year revealed their extraordinary resilience and practical wisdom. While men often dominated public decisions, women like Anna, Eleanor, and the Gowdy women provided the essential knowledge and care that sustained the community through its darkest hours. Eleanor Montpellier, the rector's wife, embodied this quiet strength. Though physically fragile with pale beauty, she possessed a sinewy mind and driving energy that transformed Anna's life. She taught Anna to read within a year of her arrival in the village, opening a world of knowledge previously inaccessible. When the plague struck, Eleanor applied her learning to map its spread through the village, analyzing patterns that might help protect the healthy rather than futilely treating the sick. The Gowdy women represented another kind of female strength, the ancient wisdom of herbal healing passed down through generations. Their independence made them targets during the crisis, but their knowledge lived on through Anna, who had learned some of their remedies. When Mary Daniels experienced a difficult breech birth, Anna successfully delivered the baby by applying techniques she had observed from Mem Gowdy, saving both mother and child when a male physician might have lost them both. Even in the midst of tragedy, women maintained the practical functions that kept survivors alive. Mary Hadfield helped with hog butchering to prepare winter food. Mothers continued caring for children despite their own grief and exhaustion. When the village held its great burning of potentially contaminated possessions, women surrendered treasured household items that represented security and comfort. A child's crib, bedding, clothing, humble objects that represented immeasurable emotional investment. The plague also forced women like Anna to step beyond traditional boundaries. She ventured into the lead mine, a traditionally male domain, to help young Mary Wickford claim her inheritance. "As I struggle against panic in the mine," Anna recalled, "each blow of my pick jars through my bones while I focus only on the work, not on the slimy darkness, choke damp air, or weight of earth above." Using the dangerous fire-setting technique that had killed her husband, Anna successfully extracted ore to prove Mary's claim, risking her life in the process. Perhaps most remarkably, women maintained their capacity for compassion even when men succumbed to cruelty or despair. When Elizabeth Bradford attempted to drown her mother's newborn illegitimate child, Anna intervened, ultimately negotiating to take the infant herself rather than allow its murder. This act of mercy, coming after Anna had lost her own children, demonstrated the extraordinary resilience of the female heart in the face of unimaginable suffering. Fire runs as a powerful metaphor throughout the plague year, both destructive and purifying, capable of bringing both death and renewal. From George Vickers' dying plea to burn it all, to the village's great communal burning of possessions, fire represented humanity's desperate attempt to cleanse what had been contaminated. Michael Montpellion's call for a great burning of possessions met initial reluctance from villagers who had already lost so much. As Anna watched the meager pile grow, she reflected on George's final words and wondered how many might have been spared had she burned his infected cloth when he first fell ill. The rector spoke with such eloquence about the cleansing power of fire that eventually the villagers complied, though Eleanor could not bring herself to burn her precious books, and Anna secretly kept Jamie's tiny jerkin she'd saved for Tom. At dusk, the village gathered around the sad pile. A child's crib, bedding, clothing, humble items representing immeasurable losses. As Michael lit the pyre with a flaming brand, they sang psalms with broken voices, scattered too far apart to maintain a common tempo. The flames consumed these physical remnants of their former lives, a ritual sacrifice that offered catharsis, if not protection. Fire appeared again when Anna ventured into the lead mine to help young Mary Wickford claim her inheritance. Using the dangerous fire-setting technique that had killed her husband, Anna built a fire against the rock face, then threw cold water on the heated stone. "The resulting explosion sends ore sheets falling everywhere," she recalled. "A heavy slab pins me face down in mud." Though nearly killed, Anna survived to bring out enough ore to prove Mary's claim. The destructive fire yielding valuable material. Even human relationships underwent trial by fire during the plague year. Michael Montpellion described his suppressed desire for Eleanor as holy fire, a passion transformed into punishment. After her death, when he attempted to seduce Anna, this fire revealed itself as something far less pure, a selfish need that had masked itself as righteousness. For Anna herself, the plague year represented a refining fire that burned away her former identity as wife and mother, leaving behind something stronger and more independent. "I once loved autumn, the stacked wood, golden hay, and tumbling apples promising winter security," she reflected at the story's beginning. "Now, with few to harvest and everyone exhausted, these comforts mean little." Yet from this desolation emerged a woman capable of delivering babies, treating illness, and ultimately forging a completely new life beyond England's shores. The plague year's crucible transformed Anna Frith from a simple village widow into a woman capable of extraordinary independence. Her journey culminated in perhaps the novel's most surprising turn, her decision to leave England entirely for a new life in the Islamic world of North Africa. After the plague subsided and Anna discovered Michael Montpellier's cruel treatment of Eleanor, she found herself unable to remain in Eam. A final crisis provided the catalyst for her departure. When she helped deliver Mrs. Bradford's illegitimate baby, she discovered Elizabeth Bradford attempting to drown the newborn in a bucket. After rescuing the infant, Anna negotiated to take the child far away to raise herself. Mrs. Bradford, grateful for both her own life and her baby's, gave Anna emerald jewelry for the child's future. Michael Montpellier, warning Anna that Elizabeth would want her dead as a witness to attempted murder, offered his horse Anteros and arranged safe passage with an ore merchant. Though initially resistant to his help, Anna accepted the horse, but ultimately decided against going to Eleanor's childhood home, instead charting her own course to the Mediterranean. Years later, we find Anna living in Oran, North Africa, in a circular room overlooking the Mediterranean. Under Ahmed Bey's tutelage, she practices medicine, helping women who would otherwise die without care. Though her faith remains tattered, she has found purpose in this new life. She now reads Avicenna's medical works in Arabic rather than Latin, having adapted to a completely different culture. The sensory world of her new home contrasts sharply with England. Intense colors of oranges and persimmons like beaten copper against the blue sky, though she sometimes misses the green of English pastures. The city teems with noise, and Anna walks after sunset prayers when the air cools. Known as Jamie, mother of Jamie, she named the Bradford baby Aisha, meaning life. The child plays in the women's courtyard with little Eleanor, named for her father's eyes, suggesting Anna has found not only purpose, but also love in this new world. This extraordinary ending reflects the novel's central theme, that catastrophe, while devastating, can also break the chains of convention and expectation. Anna's journey from domestic servant to independent healer represents a feminist triumph in an era when women's options were severely limited. By leaving behind not just her village, but her entire culture, Anna embraces a freedom that would have been unimaginable before the plague forced her to discover her own strength and question inherited beliefs. The image of Anna and her adopted daughters plunging into the jostling swarm of their city offers a final vision of life continuing after devastation. Different, unexpected, but vibrant nonetheless. Like the walnut sapling growing in Eam's main street that villagers walked around because they were too full of endings to remove this fragile beginning, Anna's new life represents the human capacity for renewal even after unimaginable loss.